Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Dave Foley.
Well, yes, well, yes.
Dave,
well,
fucking welcome. Foley.
Welcome to Really with and Tom and Dave. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm good. I'm good. Oh. We're recording on a Friday, I think, and it's beautiful sunny day.
Well, it's an evening. It's evening here. It's nighttime.
That's dark, right. When are you going to come back to us, Dave? I'm still vibing. We had this crazy trip upcoming. We will soon to be all revealed, but we had a wild Vegas trip, but not the usual kind of wild Vegas trip.
I think we can say we went to Las Vegas to spend some time with our friend George Knapp, mm-hmm. the legendary George Knapp, and did a little wandering around while we were there.
And you'll
get to hear all of the various things that George said to stun us.
Yes, indeed. Speaking of stunning, this my mind is also blown by this the book of our next guest and the theory of our next guest, to sort of jump into mm-hmm. it, because there's lots to kind of sift through here and discuss and debate, because it's fascinating stuff. Let me just give you an idea of our guest here. Dr. Michael P. Masters is a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Technological University in Butte, Montana. He received a PhD in anthropology from the Ohio State University in 2009, where he specialized in hominin evolutionary anatomy, archaeology, and biomedicine. Recent research examines the premise that UFOs and aliens could be our future human descendants returning to visit and study their own evolutionary past. In 2019, he published Identified Flying Objects, a multidisciplinary scientific approach to the UFO phenomenon, which is a broad-based scientific examination of this idea. That is really an interesting read. His second book, The Extratempestrial Model, published June 1st, 2022, further scrutinizes this time travel theory with a focus on abductee and contactee accounts in the context of this and other theories put forth to explain this complex and mysterious phenomenon. And his most recent book, Revelation, The Future Human Past, published June 1st, 2023, digs deeper into this intertemporal hominin descendants question, but in the context of a satirical time travel science fiction novel. And we're very thrilled to have Dr. Masters with us from beautiful Butte, Montana. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello.
I'm doing great. How are you two fellas doing this fine evening?
We're good. We're doing good.
Very good. Yeah, I think we sort of divvied up some of your work. We didn't intentionally. Tom has been reading Identified
Flying Objects. Yeah.
And I've been reading Extratempestrial Model.
All right.
So we're both partially informed.
But so, always the case.
But I think we're both feeling okay. We're probably not up to this task of the technical side of this. So you're gonna have to baby walk us through it.
I can absolutely do that. I will hold hands. We can walk slowly on the beach as we speak.
Excellent.
It's something I'm used to doing. It's kind of my job, to be honest, to break things down and explain them in ways people can understand. I teach 500 level classes, 100 level classes. Yeah. So yeah.
It's kind of the disadvantage of being educated is that everyone else seems dumb.
I don't know about that.
That's
at times, maybe with certain things.
I'm a high school dropout, so I'm impressed by everybody.
Well,
that's my advice. I mean, some of
the most important contributions to society came from high school dropouts. So really just, I mean, a lot of people are tapped into the space, you know, a lot of musicians, artists, any sort of creative pursuit comes from this seemingly higher place of consciousness. And it doesn't take an education to be tapped into that.
No, well, let's hope not.
There's hope for you, Dave, is what think we're getting to. There's going to be. I'm curious about. I'll be full disclosure. I am sort of new to the entire phenomenon. I've always been sort of curious about it. Mm-hmm. And in the kind of list of sort of ideas that were kind of out there, I'll be honest that when I would hear, you know, it's extra dimensional, extraterrestrial, they sort of been here a long time. They're this.
Yeah.
The time traveler thing, I was always kind of like, okay, my brain can handle so much. I can deal with aliens. I'm not sure I can handle time traveling aliens. Sure. And that's not the theory here. And having said that, going through identified flying objects you make a damn interesting case here. That certainly has risen this up the rankings, not least of which because you like very well smashed the whole idea of ET landing on our lawn. Like I was like, okay, that's just definitely not happening. But give me just an idea of your inspiration for this entire pursuit, which is done with great science, but accessible science. It's not so dense as you can't like get through it, but it's really super well reasoned. So what brought you to just jumping into this?
Yeah. And also, did you have any reservations as an academic on taking on this subject? Because it's not, a lot of academics have been pilloried for even thinking about this subject.
Absolutely. Yeah. And honestly, you know, it can answer both of those questions with the same answer, to be honest, because a big part of what I wanted to do with the first book, and a big reason why it took 7 years to write, I started writing this in 2012, is because I wanted it to be something that was understandable to everyone, but also because of that known stigma that existed even more at that time. Fortunately, it's waned a little bit coming into the present for a lot of reasons that we're aware of. I also wanted it to be something that was scientifically fastidious and really presented things in a way that my colleagues could also read it and say, well, okay, that makes sense.
Right.
He did his homework and there's a lot of references here. And these are academic papers that he's citing. It's not just various websites and whatnot. So yeah, I really did try to take an approach that was grounded in science, the principle of parsimony, kind of Occam's razor, and also what we can know, what we can't know. But I also don't just necessarily poo-poo all over the extraterrestrial model. It's possible that that's a part of this too. Like, yes, I try to make the case that there's a lot of reasons why we should consider other models as well, and especially this time travel model. But I don't necessarily think that we should just throw everything out the window and say it's time. Everything's time travel. I think that would oversimplify things. So my personal journey started when I was 8 years old. I heard about my father having a UFO encounter. And not long after, I looked up on the living room shelf, and for some reason, Whitley Strieber's classic book Communion was facing out, and I saw that cover and had sort of this mental image pop in my head of an early hominin.
This haunting image, yeah.
That's the one. I've got the same cover from that book framed sitting on my shelf facing out the same way that one was that inspired me so long ago.
Yeah.
But it sort of visualized together this early hominin or chimpanzee-like form, a modern human form, then that archetypal gray alien form, and just noticed the similarities, wondered if we could be one in the same. And from that point on, that question just lingered, and I wanted to know more about it and started out in physics and astronomy at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, and then switched to biological anthropology in order to pursue those beings themselves. And just try to figure out if they could be us, we could be them, and they're just an aspect of our own evolution.
Now, can I ask you, would you mind telling us about your father's experience?
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. He didn't talk about it much. He was very religious and saw it as the devil's work and trying to lead us away from God and all this stuff. But
wow.
I did go back and interview him in college because, again, this has always been an interest of mine. And I actually now understand it as my first instance of conscious precognition. I've had dream precognition my entire life, but this was, I've had about five of these since then where I somehow communicate with my future self or past self in seemingly odd ways, always through dreams. But this was one of those times, and it's happened enough that I can identify it as one of those times where I was awake, fully conscious, aware, and then information seemingly came from now, I guess, or my future self in some way. I know that sounds crazy to say, but it's a very real experience. Anymore.
Well, your chapter on block
time sounds crazy anymore.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you have that block time chapter was kind of blowing my mind. So I was like, okay, that's probably what's happening.
And if everything's like, if those moments are already there, you know, like I knew my children before they were born. I knew my wife before I met her. Like all those moments were there and I saw them usually through dreams. But to get back to your question, what my father saw, he was a veterinarian in Amish country in Northeast Ohio. And he was out with one of his colleagues late at night. It was about 2 or 3 in the morning, crested a hill, saw a very bright light off in the horizon. And it was just sitting there. There's not many lights in Amish country at all. And all of a sudden it shot toward their truck, hovered about maybe 100 yards away in front of them, shot back to where it was, hovered for a little while longer, and then straight up into the sky and disappeared. And there's not a lot of prosaic explanations for something like that. So naturally, it piqued his curiosity. And I think that's what led him to get Whitley's book.
And he got Whitley's book, and his conclusion was one of keep that away. This is
when I interviewed him about it in college, just to make sure I fully understood, because I was, you know, 8 years old when I overheard this, and he was talking to friends. I was supposed to be in bed, and I just wanted to make sure I had the course of events right, that this was a real thing, this did happen, and so I asked him about it, and that's when he kind of went down the don't follow this path, Satan. I'll stick pitchforks up your ass or whatever they do. I don't know. So I did anyway. Pitchforks be damned, I guess.
As kids will do, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Go figure.
Well, it's interesting because you say, even though you've presented such a strong argument in both of your two books, that you're not putting it forward as the only answer, and that we should answer other versions, which reminded me that there was a while back Hal Puthoff put out like an essay where he did say we shouldn't dismiss the demonic as a possible explanation.
True. Yeah. The ultra terrestrial model, I think, is what he called it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good. He said the same thing. Let's start with everything. All of these models. I did a whole talk about this in Phoenix in May, and then let's whittle away the ones that don't fit the data. And I think that's a great approach for all of us.
Yeah. Try to find evidence to dismiss an idea as opposed to just dismissing it out of hand.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which I think is a great way to approach it. And so I guess that's such, so your interest in this is from childhood, and you say you have precognition experiences.
A lot.
And that's ongoing. And those also go back to childhood, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ever, as long as I can remember, I would dream things and then they would come true. And sometimes it'll be a few days, sometimes weeks, sometimes decades, but I'll still remember that dream. And it's not just what I see. It's all of my anxieties. It's the smells, it's situations. It's what's going on in my life at that time. All of that information somehow transcends time in this sort of ethereal consciousness that happens in a dream state.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was so? I'm kind of still reeling from some of the sort of time travel chapters and thinking about nonlinear time and thinking about time as kind of a biological, you know, construction versus being an actual
good way of putting it. Yeah,
reality.
Right.
Do you think this was meant to be that you were writing this? I mean, do you believe that you were destined to write this book? Do you think there was another path you might have taken? It sounds like through the book identified. So you call, by the way, you call these things IFOs, identified flying objects. To
well, just in that book.
Yeah, suggested in there. That book.
It was a cheeky little thing. Like, let's get away from the stigma of UFOs, which right. now we can talk about as UFOs again, because they're real.
Yeah.
Go figure. Mm-hmm. Who knew that we'd be able to say that?
I think we're definitely dealing with a phenomenon in the skies and in people's lives and through dreams and abduction experiences. So I guess one of my questions is, do you feel like that was you telling you to write this book? I mean, do you feel like this was, you know, destined to be?
Well, I think a lot of people have this experience. I was on a panel at the Opening the Archives conference at Rice University last March with Eric Wargo, who literally wrote the book on this, a book called Time Loops, where he lays out what precognition is, how it might work in the context of the block universe, quantum mechanics, all of these very scientific pursuits that might help explain it. But in the block universe, yeah, those moments are there. You know, it's easy for us consciously to remember our past moments, but future moments, if we're in a dream state or near-death experiences or DMT trips or, you know, possibly even acid, other psychedelics, you sort of disassociate from this fleshy meatbag brain body thing that holds our consciousness in. And once it's released from that, time disappears. People talk about being able to see in all directions at the same time, but not feeling time, not sensing it in the way that we do in these bodies. And as you pointed out, a lot of it's because we had to evolve to recognize how fast a tiger's coming at us and how fast we have to get into a tree. It's a biological requisite of living in these environments, and we evolved to that. But outside of our perception of time, it doesn't exist in the way that we perceive it. There isn't linear time in that way. So it's not crazy to say that if those moments are there and you have access to those moments in a dream state or an altered state of consciousness, then yeah, you could absolutely get glimpses of them. I don't think it was some sort of predestination type thing. I think I was just more aware of what I'm doing now, I guess, essentially. And, right. and it's almost cheating in a way. Like, you're kind of getting a sneak peek into what's going on later. Like cheating on the test kind of a little bit, I guess.
Now the block, the block time or block universe. Is that your, is that the Einsteinian like view of the universe and how time, you know, past, present, future, all coexisting, and that you can sort of intersect different points in time if depending on what, how you're traveling, like how you're traveling sort of, you know, I guess, perpendicular to the, I guess, to the space time.
Sort of. Yeah. It's also sometimes called landscape time. And if you picture, all of these various moments that have happened spread out across a landscape, you can jump across them and end up in places that already exist in physical reality, whether it be a part of your past or a part of your future, and you're not disrupting anything. That's the important part. And Tom, when you were talking earlier about how you sort of struggled with the concept, a lot of people get hung up on this. And I think much of it is owed to the crap storylines that were put out through the 80s and 90s with regard to how time travel might work, because it doesn't work the way Back to the Future describes it. If you go into the past, it's non-disruptive. You're not changing anything. You're just going into the past and doing the same things you had always done in those moments. If you interact with your future self, you can be damn sure that by the time you get to be that age, you will be going back and interacting with your past
right.
self.
Right. We're not, there are no billions of probabilities we're on. There is a sort of fixed future and past in a weird, despite the landscape, despite block time, we're existing all at one time.
Yeah.
It is the same time for
all of us. You're not obliterating your future by altering your past.
By killing grandpa.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And those paradoxes disappear in the block universe model because all the time is already structured. If you didn't kill your grandfather, there's no way to do that because you exist and he exists. And that's just the way those moments are structured and always have been and always will be. There are other theories in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, multiple timelines, multiple universes. In those scenarios, you can have branching timelines and you can have change, which does interject those paradoxes. But in the block universe model, which is the most conventionally held model in physics, I didn't just pull this out of my ass. You know, this is what physicists think is the case. And because of that, I can only start from this point in time with what we know now. And that's what I did with this book. I try to be very conservative in my approach, acknowledge when something was speculative, acknowledge when something, you know, can't necessarily be backed up by evidence. But the block universe model does seem to make sense, not just in reality, but also with regard to this phenomenon.
I have to, and let's take this chronologically back, if you can, because you are a biological anthropologist. And one of the things I found most compelling, really, and hadn't fully taken it in, was how unique our structure, our biological structure, is in not just on our planet, but in the galaxy. I guess my question to you is, in your opinion, what are the odds that another bipedal, highly intelligent, fleshy being will evolve in our, or has evolved in our galaxy? What would you say the odds of that are?
Well, in our galaxy, possibly. In our universe, more likely, but close enough that they would find us, that they could travel here, and that they would be just slightly more advanced than we are at this current time, I would say is next to zero. And there's been so many things that went into our unique evolution on this planet. And the dinosaurs had to die 65 million years ago for homeothermic ancestors of ours, these tiny little rodent-like mammals, to come out. They had to go into the trees where we evolved for about 60 million years. And then 6 to 8 million years ago, we came down from the trees and started walking on two legs and adapted to that. And that's just a microcosm of all of the other things that would have to exist on this hypothetical other planet. And as I point out in a number of lectures I've given, we have a very small planet. And bipedalism is almost non-existent here. We're the only upright walking mammal on this whole damn planet. And from a study I did in 2016, and then again, I repeated it last year, what I found is between 2 and 4% of all of the exoplanets that have been discovered, and we're talking thousands now, only 2 to 4% are the same size or smaller than our Earth. Mm. So with only 9.8 meters per second squared of gravity, and it's so difficult here, and we're the only ones doing it, and we suffer all kinds of problems from being bipedal.
Right.
I mean, the older I get, I start to feel these day in and day out anymore. But if it's so rare here, it's likely to be even more rare on these other planets simply because there's more gravity.
Many of them
are massive super-Earths.
And the context of this question that I should have pointed out was that you are saying that because of that communion image of that alien gray, the sort of classical alien that is bipedal, has the big head, the big eyes, the small mouth, communicates with us in a way that we can understand many times with abduction phenomena.
Can breathe our air too.
Breathe our air. And you were making the kind of putting that in context of like how likely is an alien to have those same physical attributes.
Right. Yeah. And not only would we not expect them to have the same ones, but to have the ones we would expect to see in our evolutionary future specifically. Like, we expect bigger, broader heads, bigger eyes, because the eye grows out of the brain and they're thought to be controlled by the same gene mechanisms, what's called pleiotropy. We would expect to have more slender bodies, less pigmentation, more craniofacial feminization, more neoteny and pedomorphosis, which is the retention of juvenile traits into adulthood. And so many of these abductees and contactees, like Terry Lovelace and Travis Walton, describe these as children, childlike, infantile. And that's a trait we would expect, because that characteristic of human evolution is extremely dominant all throughout. So we'd expect that our descendants would look more like our current children. And that's exactly what we see. Yeah. So not just that we look the same or act the same or can breathe the same air, can communicate, but they look exactly like we'd expect them to if we continue to evolve.
We should maybe point out to people who haven't read your books or your bio that this was your field of study before you started writing books about UFOs, was you were studying the evolution, the cranial evolution of hominids.
Yes. And
this came out of your academic work.
Yes. But, you know, again, full circle, I went into this field because of this question too.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's cool.
So it was about, you know,
you're all about time loops. Everything's a loop with you.
Well, you see them enough and you start to say, what the fuck is going on here? You know, and that happened to me very early in my life. I was like, what? How did I dream this before it happened? And I was forced to think about it, you know, and then as I got the ability to, I was consuming every time travel book I could in high school and college just to try to figure out what that was. But in the back of my mind was always that lingering question. Could they be us? And obviously, I have to point out, there could be selection bias, you know, in doing that. There can be all kinds of biases. Like, am I just looking for that? And I, as a scientist, we're forced to check that, all of our biases. But I also, what was interesting is the more I went down this rabbit hole in undergraduate, graduate school, even in my research, my postgraduate research and my career, everything just seems to still fit this idea. It makes sense, you know, not just in our physical evolution, but the technology, the form follows function aspect of these craft, the demonstrated ability for them to manipulate time, manipulate the space-time metric, as Hal Podoff says. Just all of these things seem to fit together. And again, that doesn't mean I discount all of the theories, but I do think this one should be taken seriously.
Yeah, there was so much, like, you make a convincing case. Even the idea, I was like, well, you know, it's not that even intelligence is inevitable. Just in terms of sort of trying to kind of put aside extraterrestrial for a moment to allow time traveler to become more of a kind of idea, the idea of intelligence is just not inevitable, right? I mean, it's, you know, if so, sharks would be, you know, have IQs of 200, right? They'd be, yes. I mean, this is a unique kind of, is our intelligence just an aspect of circumstance? I mean, is it just a sort of circumstantial that our intelligence developed?
Well, maybe, but there's also, again, a biological explanation. I talk about this a good bit in the, I think maybe chapter 8 in that book you're reading, Tom, where as we stood upright, importantly, our heads had to rotate down so we could see where we were going. So our eyes were aligned with the horizon. And as that happened, it flexed our basocranium, which opened up more space inside the skull where a bigger brain could go. So in a lot of ways, like, there was obviously selective pressure and sexual selection, smartest gets laid and has more babies and all these things. But even beyond that, just the fact that we stood upright, flexed our basocranium, like, if you think, we often call this the slinky hypothesis. If you imagine two parts of a slinky, either end, you bend them toward each other, which is exactly what happened. The brainstem, where it goes in, the foramen magnum came forward and our faces became reduced and retracted. So as you bend the two ends of that slinky down, it bows out on the top. And that's exactly what happened to our skull. So we got this enlarged neurocranium where we could eventually start packing in more and more brain tissue. So yeah, again, it's a unique aspect of our evolution that may have contributed to our high intelligence as well.
Yeah, and then the evolution continues theoretically.
Yeah.
Theoretically.
So with the becoming an upright species, you're saying enlarge that, just that reorientation of the body, enlarged the cranium. Is that, because I don't really know what I'm talking about now, but that idea that there was an unexplained acceleration of our mental capacity at a certain point in our evolution.
That's definitely part of it. Yeah. So the flexing of the neurocranium, the basocranium that allowed the neurocranium to expand, that's sort of an early, well, not early, but it's something that didn't necessarily make our brains grow. You're right. There has to be other factors involved. And we call it this brain behavior feedback loop, or the runaway brain train. Because you're right. It just started accelerating like crazy. And especially beginning about 800,000 years ago with our Homo heidelbergensis-ish ancestors, and really up into modern times. There's this rapid evolution of brain size. And that most likely has to do with our culture. And in anthropology, we can't separate culture and biology. They became one thing with humans. As we invented fire, for instance, and stone tools, we processed our food so that our face could shrink back and get out of the way of that brain. And then all of the things that come with being more intelligent, being able to make better tools, being able to, like I said, have more babies because you attract more mates, because you're suave, or you speak better, you tell stories better, you make cave paintings, and everybody's like, ooh, look at the artist, let's go have sex with him, you know? So there's a lot of other things involved, but that importance of just standing up is maybe paramount in an early setting the stage capacity. And then you're right, Dave, all of these other things came later.
Yeah, because I'd heard some theories that it was the our ability to cook meat. Like, we started eating meat, which allowed us to store more fat.
See, what are you talking about? You know all kinds of shit about this. That's called the expensive tissue hypothesis. And you're right. Yeah, when we started eating meat, it reduced our gut and it allowed more energy to go up to our brains. And meat is a better source for the evolving brain. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And then when we learned to cook it, we could actually better process it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's all related.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about also in this, and then we can kind of, I want to move into like, you know, abduction and how, you know, these creatures talk to us. But it was, even if intelligence does evolve in our galaxy or on some of these exoplanets, because I think you were starting to say, you know, because of the size of these planets, the gravity is going to accommodate a different level of locomotion, right? So even if there's something intelligent developed, it's probably going to have eight legs or, you know, be kind of close to the ground, right? Or sort of rolling around. It's just it's not going to look like us. It seems very unlikely that anything visiting us would look like us, much less communicate like us. Talk a little bit about vibration. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. We would expect, and you know, it's important to focus on the fact that we are unique. We have a very unique evolutionary history here, but there are certain things that everything would have, most likely a sense of smell, and vibrational sensitivity, because you need to know if things are around you that can kill you or that you want to mate with or that you can eat if they are also moving. So that's one that's definitely going to happen. I think the part you're talking about in the book is I also mention that a lot of other animals that still use vibrational communication isn't in the range of our hearing. So elephants, for instance, are talking to each other all the time, but it's in the infrasound. It's below our range of hearing. And I think I mentioned the demon African mole rat that just pounds its head on its tunnel. It's still communicating through vibrations, but you have to know what those mean and be in the tunnel. And so there's a lot of specifics to all of it too. But yeah, we would expect them in sight. The eye evolved something like 15 times independently because it's so important to perceive movement around you too. So those are certainly there. But again, once you focus on how we look specifically, being upright walking, and I oftentimes cite the Dr. Edgar Mitchell free study. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was published around the same time as my first book. But they surveyed across the world in 17 different languages, over 3,500 people. The most commonly described form was human, just like us. Like not humanoid, humanish, but human. And that was a failing going from my first book to my second, as I kind of overlooked that fact. I mostly focused on the grays and long distance human evolution. But in my second book, there's a number of cases where it's normal looking humans like us that come out, don't even speak telepathically yet, but speak in vocalized communicative speech. And and then the second most common form is the short grays, then the tall grays, and then the hybrids. And importantly, by definition, all four of those are upright walking hominins. They're in our evolutionary clade.
But then that still leaves, you know, from abduction testimony, insectoids like the mantids and the
Mothman, dog man, reptilians. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't have an explanation. Like I said, I, you know, don't, unless we, I'm not trying to offer.
Do we need to keep an eye on our praying mantises right now?
That's well, not yet. Yeah. And here's why.
Yeah.
Or that's a fair question.
Keep the reptiles under our thumb.
I'm more worried about the reptiles.
Me too.
Yeah. Me too. Like if I had a chameleon, I'd be sleeping with one eye open. Here's the thing about the mantids though, that a lot of people overlook, is that they have six legs. These mantid beings aren't being described as having six legs. Therefore, they're not a part of the insect kingdom. They're tetrapods like us. They have four limbs. And I think what's going on here is that we're talking about a very distant point in the human future. And these ones with the huge eyes, you know, high level of consciousness, they seem to be the ones in charge. I'm sure you've come across that from looking at the abduction literature too. Mm-hmm. And we would expect that of the very distant humans with this highly evolved consciousness, where they're just sort of, you know, overseeing this whole operation with their super brains and, you know, commanding the whole thing. So I think we're confusing very distant future humans for a praying mantis-like creature. I don't know what to tell you about the reptilians. There's a connection between Sasquatch and UFOs. I don't know what that is either, but it's definitely important to pay attention to those things.
I think I would love to sort of talk about motive. You know, one of the things that is constantly kind of coming up in these conversations, like, we don't know what they want. You know, it's like their movements are so mysterious. They don't seem to, talk to us as an anthropologist about what you feel their motives might be, how that loops into this whole theory.
Yeah, it's a great question. I just gave a talk in Cincinnati last month, 2 months ago, and that was the whole question: is friend or foe? What is their intent? You know, and obviously we can't know that until they tell us, but we can look at what they're doing and start to tease out what the motivations for those activities might be. And one pattern that keeps recurring is gamete extraction. For decades, they were capturing us, taking sperm and egg, putting developing fetuses inside females and taking them back out. I list one case in my my second book, The Extratempestrial Model, where this was happened almost 30 to 40 times to this one poor woman named Jerry, who eventually came to accept it. And she was okay with it because she was part of something bigger. And a lot of contactees describe that. But so I think this focus on gametes is extremely informative. I think it indicates that there's some aspect of our evolutionary future where we start having problems with reproduction. And they're coming back to sample wild type gametes, wild type genes, from the only time they can, because we can't just go to another planet and start taking human DNA from animals that evolved, like we talked about earlier. They would be so different from us that we wouldn't be compatible. Right. But we can, if we can go into the past, something goes wrong, either because of CRISPR or fertility issues related to current issues even. There's been a 60% reduction in sperm counts in males in the Western world in just 40 years. 60% reduction in 40 years, 50% across the entire human population. So if these trends continue, we may have to fix something, and it may help explain that. So that could be an aspect of the intention there. But I think it's also hard because we are likely talking about very different groups, even if they're coming from the same time. I don't think they are. I think they're spread out across eons in the future. But even if they are, you'd expect variation just in the fact that some people now are nice and some people are assholes. You know, so you're going to get different things from different individual personalities, different groups. So I think as far as saying, why are they here? What do they want? We have to define which they are we talking about and from what time and from what region. And, you know, I think it's impossible to just put one label on it, but there does seem to be these recurring themes, and the gamete extraction is certainly one of those.
There, sorry, Dave, did you have a...
No, you go.
Yeah,
no,
I was going to, I mean... I was going to ask about your father, for example, saw his those lights in Amish country, which is of course so remote. And in so many cases, we see the, you know, there, it seems like that in these remote locations, places low, you know, the population density, you know, Arizona lights notwithstanding, you know, the Phoenix lights.
Right.
Most of the time, we're talking about remote areas. I thought that might be a motive for not being discovered. And I guess that still applies, even if time is fixed. Is there still this potential sense that not to intrude or not to overly make a spectacle of yourself, you know, if you're showing up as a time traveler? I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Just the elusiveness of
them. Right. And, you know, I've said for a long time, if they are extraterrestrials, and they come all the way across the galaxy, why not shake a hand and say, hey, we're your galactic neighbors. We're all in the same galaxy. But that doesn't seem to be the case. There's almost this temporal prime directive where they go out of their way not to interfere. And that is something that we would expect with future humans coming back into the past to a time that predates broad knowledge of who they are, when they're coming from, what they're doing. So yeah, in my opinion, I think we would expect exactly what we're seeing. I think that's further evidence for this theory. But I think we can also acknowledge, and we could take a three-person poll on this because I'd like to know your thoughts as well. But I think we can say at this point that we are shifting toward full knowledge of what's going on. It feels that way. And I've studied this my entire life. Actually, this is kind of a full circle moment for me because I kind of had not a great childhood, but I'd be so excited about coming home after school. And I'd watch Monty Python's Flying Circus, Kids in the Hall, and then whatever UFO show I could find. And it was like the bright aspect of my day. I was like, I can't wait to get home and just laugh for a while. You know, and it's funny talking to you, Dave, right now, because it was such a important part of my youth. But I think that we're, by the way, you guys came out blasting with the reboot of that too.
Oh, thank you.
I've been watching that over the last couple of months, and I've been telling all my friends to watch it too. It's absolutely hilarious.
It's awesome.
In any case, I got off track there. Yep. So yeah, I do think we're moving toward knowledge of this, and I think it's going to be that moment where we do get to know. You know, I used to say this even in 2019 when I first started talking about this stuff. I was like, well, it'd be so great if we could know in our lifetime. I think it's almost inevitable at this point. I think it's going to be in the next 5 to 10 years that we will have the answers to a lot of these questions that have eluded us for so long.
Mm-hmm. I am privately and now publicly rooting for the time traveler idea, just because I think some of the other ideas are beginning to sound a bit more sinister and maybe, you know, not so great of what is going to be disclosed if it gets disclosed.
Yeah, there's some doom and gloom, isn't there?
Potentially, yes, yeah. there's some weirdness out there. I mean, my feeling about disclosure and whether we will know. Well, I think we are knowing. I think people know. There is a group that seems to just know and accept that we know. Whereas there's others that are catching up to this idea of like, wait, do we know? You know, they're not paying as close attention. And whether or not someone's going to come out and tell us, my opinion changes every, you know, afternoon. Like, I'm like, fuck it. Like they're playing the same games.
Here's the thing. It's not up to them anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has anything to do with them. I think they are trying to catch up with what is already in the books. It's already happening. And I've been saying this for years now. I think the visitors are the ones leading this. Look at the Schumer Amendment. Look at what's happening with Congress and the way that they're scrambling to try to get into these meetings to ask informed questions. They're trying to figure out what the hell is going on to try to get on board before everything hits the fan. I don't think they're leading it. I think they're following it.
Well, that's why I've said I think that things like the Schumer's proposed legislation, it's all, as I said, it's a negative impression of the information they have that we don't have.
That's a great way of putting it.
And I do think for someone like Chuck Schumer, who's a pretty mainstream politician, pretty much a centrist liberal, but and not a guy who takes a lot of huge risks, this is way, way, way out of character for him to write this legislation.
Yeah, and look at the words in it. Look at the language, the lexicon. It's all the words we've been using for decades.
25 usages of non-human intelligence.
No, I'm just that. Even if I take that glass half empty view, which sometimes I do, which is just like, okay, well, is he somehow responding to popular demand, that there's a demand among the public to put forward UFO legislation? And I'm like, there's a constituency in the sense that, like, I do think people want to know, and I'm sure some of the phones are ringing off the hook. And I think, but in terms of motivating the majority leader to put his name on legislation that honors Harry Reid, who clearly believed the government was not sharing and probably knew, and I think it's fair to say knew that they weren't sharing all their information. I do think it's really significant. I've been somewhat discouraged by that. It seems like some senators, like Warner, people are beginning to veer around and away from it. But in the bigger picture, to your point, it does seem like a boulder that's rolling down the hill
There is no political upside to it. I mean, because
I can see
this is a hugely significant piece of legislation. And it has had zero coverage in the media. Like no one. And so only this, like maybe 1 or 2% of the population that are involved in this issue know about it or care about it.
It's almost like there's maybe like.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Social and political rapture coming, and they don't want to be left behind. They don't want to be the ones that are like, oh no, what the hell is going on? They want to get out in front of it. And like the fact that Grush and Fravor and Graves hearing that happen, like you have people from both sides of the aisle asking extremely informed questions that if you asked me 5 years ago, if they would be asking anything close to that, I'd say you were crazy.
Yeah.
But they're clearly getting very detailed, classified information for a reason on both sides. What other thing has brought people that are such polar opposites together to ask such informed questions?
Seeing Jamie Raskin and Tim Burchett on a panel is the closest thing I've seen to a miracle in my lifetime. And that they were all there together, and none of them took the opportunity to snipe at one another.
No, not at all. You almost expected Jesus to come down right there.
And, it was quite astonishing. And you've got the Schumer Amendment on one side, and then you know, kind of
Gillibrand.
Nancy Mace on the in the House. Yeah. It was like we are talking very extreme.
Things are happening. I'll double down on that. I think we'll know in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah,
well, and I think there's a very good chance that it's going to come out their future humans. I don't know if you've read Joe McMonagle's book, The Ultimate Time Machine, about his future.
No, I haven't. Although we were just talking to Chris Ramsey about, and he had just done a lengthy sort of series on Joe McMonagle.
Yeah, remote viewing.
I watched Ramsey's
name's so hard to say.
Yeah, McMonagle.
Yeah, well, he says I published my second book last year. And then we went on a trip back to Ohio, and I was reading that book while there, literally 2 weeks after I published it. And on page like 177, he says that he remote viewed the future, pretty proximal parts, and then 3,000 years in the future. And the future sounds delightful, by the way. It's very hopeful if you're feeling downtrodden about humanity. I know we all need that, especially right now.
Yeah.
But he said explicitly by the mid 21st century, so coming up, that there will be broad understanding that UFOs, for lack of a better word, are time machines. And I was like, God damn it. Why didn't I read that 2 weeks ago before I published this book arguing that they're time machines? This remote viewer saying the same thing for completely different reasons.
And I have to disclose, like, I don't have a weighted system for which model I think is the most likely to be the case, whether it's extra-dimensional, extraterrestrial, or extra-tempestrial. I think they're all possible. But I got to say, I've always found the extra-tempestrial to be the one that's always a little disappointing to me.
Yeah, people say that. I know. Because it's us.
Yeah, and I don't want it to be us. Because I want to know that we get off the block, that we get, you know.
But maybe we do. Maybe we do. And I honestly, one of my editors pointed this out, that we might be extraterrestrials too, where we go on to occupy all these other planets. Obviously, these craft can travel very fast. They can manipulate space-time, so they could probably get to another planet like that. They might not even have to deal with all of the time dilation aspects. And he was like, you know, maybe like with Betty Hill and all these people say we're from this star system or this planet. Maybe they've just been there so long that they don't think about their earthly origins anymore. Like when people ask me where I'm from, I don't say Wales, even though all my ancestors are from Wales. I say that I'm from Montana or Ohio. You know, that's about as far as I go back.
Right.
So, you know, maybe some of them are extraterrestrial, but still possibly humans from a distant point.
That's sort of the foundation, as Asimov, isn't it? That humans populate the entire galaxy.
It's very possible. Yeah. I would say even probable. If we have that technology, I don't think we just use it for time travel. I think we definitely do interstellar travel as well.
We become our own aliens. Talk about the ships a little bit. Talk about why you feel what we see or what people see is more indicative of time travel, or why it might suggest that.
Right. So as I briefly mentioned earlier, we have this expression that form follows function. And mostly it refers to biological things, like the form of our digits indicate the function of grasping and whatnot. But it applies to everything. And the form of these craft is very consistent with the function of creating closed time-like curves, which would allow you to travel into the past. So to think of closed time-like curves, you have to understand what a light cone is. So if you turn on a beam of light, a flashlight, and it beam shot out, it makes a cone where within that is all possibilities in the known universe based on our laws of physics, because nothing can go faster than light. But in order to travel into the past, you have to rotate those light cones over. So really, since Einstein's paper on general relativity in 1915, instantly, very soon after, there are all of these solutions that demonstrated how the rotation of a highly energetic or highly massive ring, disk, or sphere could create that frame dragging effect. It could create the ability to tip those light cones over. So you and your local frame of reference are still moving forward, but you're going into the global past. You're jumping into the past. It's not that you see everything moving backwards like they do in a lot of time travel movies,
right?
But you're still moving forward. So there was Lenz and Thurein in 1917, so just 2 years after, and then you had Gödel and Van Stockholm, and then importantly, you had in the 1970s, Frank Tipler show how if you shrink that thing down to the size and shape of a disc and rotate it fast enough, you can create these time light curves, these closed time light curves. And that's a UFO. He's describing a UFO. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I don't think it's that simple. Since I published that in 2019, that was an interesting correlation that I put in there because I think it's important, especially looking at the history over the last, you know, 110 years since the seminal paper. But I do think it's more nuanced than that. I don't know how they're doing it. Possibly harnessing zero point energy to be able to even accomplish this, but they clearly are manipulating space time around these craft. And in the book you're reading, Dave, I give all of these examples of people seeing time move differently, or they disappear, like Corporal Armando Valdez. He disappears for 15 minutes according to his men, but 5 days passed for him. His watch read 5 days in the future. He had beard growth indicative of right. 5 days of beard growth. There's all of these other cases like that. So I think they are the time machines themselves, the discs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the triangle craft are. I think those are something completely different. But the discs seem to have a form that's consistent with the function of traveling backward in time.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, obviously, you've said you're open to the idea that there are multiple, that since, I mean, we talk about that there being multiple species visiting and multiple, when we're talking about extraterrestrial. So is it, do you think there could be extraterrestrial component to the UFO phenomena as well as an extratempestrial component and pan-dimensional? Do you think all of these things could be simultaneously overlapping in our world?
I do, yeah. I've come to think that they're all the same thing. And this, I referenced this talk I gave in Phoenix a few months ago. I guess it was May now. For someone who studies time, I'm horrible with that. Like, oh, that was a couple of months. No, that was 5 years ago, honey.
Yeah, exactly.
But I have exactly that problem. I have no internal chronometer at all.
He doesn't. Awesome. I'll vouch for that.
So I gave this talk because I started with Hal's paper that you referenced earlier as a jumping off point. Because he says that in his abstract of the paper, that it could be any or some iteration of all of these. And I took that as kind of a way to move into how could it be all. And so I gave this 2-hour lecture, which is exhausting, by the way. No lecture should ever be 2 hours long.
It's a lot.
But I gave this 2-hour lecture about how if we interject the variable of time, and you and I just, you know, this happened to come up, but even we could potentially explain how you might have humans on other planets saying they're from other planets, even if their original origination right. point is on Earth. But then the crypto-terrestrial model, how you could have them walking amongst us through these hybridization programs where they retain that high consciousness, telepathic abilities, clairvoyance, maybe even telekinesis, obviously future knowledge if they do come from the future. But then the interdimensional, I think that's just another aspect of time travel. I see those as one of the same. But the one that I think it really helps explain is the sort of breakaway civilization, how we could have sophisticated, highly advanced civilizations that predate the point in time where we go through all of the phases necessary to get to that level of sophistication. And the way that could happen is if they're jumping over into the past. So say we screw up this world, you know, we nuke everything, or climate change just makes it all go to shit. And then they don't want to live here anymore. Why not jump over and go live in a pristine, beautiful world prior to the Anthropocene, when we came in and started harnessing all these fossil fuels and mucking everything up. And so we might see indications of that. Maybe Atlantis was real. Maybe they're future humans that jumped over. There's no way you could have a breakaway civilization. We couldn't have Homo erectus just suddenly start making rocket ships, or with the crypto-terrestrials going underground and testing spaceships underground. It's nonsensical if you really start breaking it down and thinking about it. But we could have those scenarios if you have the same evolutionary process from simple to complex. Then you have complex jumping over back to a point of simple. So if you start to interject the time variable, again, I'm not saying this explains everything or should whitewash everything with time. But if you do think about it in the context of all these moments being connected, these different models kind of blend into one, in my opinion.
Talk about a little bit the... There's some audience members of Ancient Aliens that might be disappointed by some of the stuff that you talk about in Identified Flying Objects. But the I thought it was interesting. We talked when you talk about the imagery, when you talk about some of the ways that customs of cultures of how they maybe have changed their bodies to look at a certain way. I mean, talk a little bit about what you maybe don't think is the proof of aliens and what you think might be the proof of aliens in our past or extempestrial or, you know.
Right. That's a great question. And, you know, I have a very contentious relationship with Ancient Aliens because the show innately is sort of racist because it's always aliens build everything outside of Europe. You know, the Europeans could do
they figured that
fine,
out, yeah.
But they got a check. They're fine. But I've been on the show 5 times too. So it's like, you know, I can only talk so much shit about it. Yeah, I know. It has gotten a lot better though. The program is far better than it used to be. And they really exposed a lot of people to this question, which is extremely important. They're probably more than anybody else responsible for getting out there. And so we can't take that away from them. So yeah, what you're referring to is what's known as intentional cranial modification. I know way more about this than I should because it was a big part of my general exams when I was doing my doctorate. I had learned all about the craniofacial changes and integration and modularity and all this stuff I won't bore you with. But the really interesting part of it is that it's found throughout the world going back tens of thousands of years. So these independent human populations were all modifying their heads in the same way. And in a way that would be excruciating to the babies that they're doing it to. You would have to sit there and listen to your baby cry as you smashed its head from front to back, cranial boarding or wrapping, just to make its head look more like
something.
These aliens.
Yeah, something. Right?
Something. Mm-hmm. But the fact that their craniofacial form after this is more like these archetypal gray aliens, I don't think that's a coincidence. And one anthropologist, well, I'm guessing they were married. I don't know. Geertsen and Geertsen were their names, published a paper in 1995 that demonstrated that they were doing this, that because we do something called bioarchaeological, there's a lot of things. It's ethnoarchaeology specifically is when we dig stuff up and then compare it to what we've learned from the people that are still alive at that time. Mm. I don't feel like I explained that very well, but you dig something up, if there's still ancestors of those people, yeah. You say, hey, what's this? Mm-hmm. What was this for? So they were asking, through oral tradition, they learned that their ancestors were instructed by the gods to do this intentional cranial modification to look more like them. So they're saying we were told to do this. And the fact that it existed all over the world, going back to the time of Neanderthals, I think is interesting. Then you have things like the Owlman, the Wajina cave paintings in northwest Australia. Over and over, you see these big-headed, big-eyed, overly large eyes for their head and the body size. Why would that be? You know, these patterns, if you look at them enough, they start to indicate what might be happening. And it's very likely that the same phenomenon we see now, same descriptions of these same beings, were likely visiting them too. And think about that for a second. If you had, say, humans coming from 10,000 years in our future, and they also visited people 30,000 years in the past, the exact same people, they're going to represent them in a way that's completely detached from the way we represent them. or have the ability to understand them. A lot of things in the Bible, and this is all the point of my third book, is to demonstrate how many of these aspects of our belief system may have arisen from these instances of close contact as well. And Ezekiel's the obvious one, but there's a number of others that we might want to consider too. And he's describing a wheel within a wheel, burning embers, these human forms. All of these things are exactly how we would describe these same sorts of things if we lived thousands of years ago. But now we have the ability to talk about lights and electromagnetism and shiny metals. They didn't have that frame of reference. Mm-hmm. So I think that, again, is sort of an indication of time travel, where we're talking about the same phenomenon just being depicted in different ways based on the level of sophistication of the people observing it.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, because if you have no technology, you're not going to apply a technological framework to something.
Right. How do you? Yeah, you don't even have that.
I mean, their cave painting is our Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know.
That's a great way of putting it.
Better at cinematography, but the same kind of, these are the gods we can't quite explain, this is something.
And whoever painted that was probably the Steven Spielberg of that time.
Exactly.
Too.
The one that's getting all the ladies, you know,
which is encouraging, because I thought it used to be just the strong ones that got laid.
Yeah. It is encouraging. So,
that's what I'm telling you. It's the big brained ones too. It's the creatives, you know, they're the ones sneaking behind the bush and hoping they don't get caught by the big ones.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You gotta be sharp.
That was always my gig.
The cuttlefish that passes female, so they can get past the big cuttlefish and mate.
That's right, the sneaky ones.
I'll float something past you then that I brought up a couple of times on our podcast. Because I always try to think of, well, how can I make myself more depressed about things?
Yeah, I think, Dr. Masters, we need your help with Dave, just in terms of not, you know, bringing the room down too much. And
I'm here for you. I'm here for you, buddy.
But I know that a lot of people who are interested in the UFO issue and who are very upset about the idea of the threat narrative involving UFOs, and they'll always... Their argument is always, well, they've been here for thousands and thousands of years, and they haven't wiped us out yet. So that must be evidence that they are benign. And I have the thought that comes into my head after when I hear that, well, if they are extra tempestrial travelers, then maybe their relationship to time is very different from our relationship to time.
Yeah.
And what if they actually arrived here an hour ago, but they arrived here at all points in time simultaneously? So to us, it would appear they've been here for thousands of years, but to their own frame of reference, they may have only been sizing us up as a species for a very short period of time.
Yeah, if they're extraterrestrial, you mean?
Extraterrestrial and time traveling as well. That maybe they're creatures, you know, like in the movie Arrival, those creatures were... I guess pan-temporal, we'd call them.
They were, that's a good way of putting it. Whitley Strieber talked about that same idea toward the end of his book, where they could come here as extraterrestrials and be like, whoa, they clearly have a history, let's go back and study it.
Mm-hmm. So that's like so you're thinking like the ships are landing in ancient Egypt and our time simultaneously, because they're not picky about that. That's an interesting one.
For them, I think for them, they may experience time as a, you know, as I said, pan-temporally, we'll say
that they
exist at all points in time simultaneously.
Yeah, that was the impetus behind Slaughterhouse 5 too, the Tralfamadorians, Kurt Vonnegut's classic novel. Yeah, that's absolutely a possibility. How are you relating that to the threat narrative, though? I'm curious.
Well, because it takes away the comforting notion that they've been here for so long and they haven't decided to destroy us yet.
Yeah.
Because in their frame of reference, they may have only been here for half an hour.
Right.
So they may not have come to a conclusion about us, even though that to us, they would appear to be here for thousands of years.
Yeah. Well, I think it does definitely not necessarily throw a wrench in, but make you reconsider that as an explanation for why they haven't harmed us. And I think that's where you're going with this. Like, well, can we just say they're benevolent because they haven't killed us and enslaved us and eaten us or destroyed us or whatever? If they are extraterrestrials and they're time traveling, then that could definitely be an aspect of it. I would almost be more worried about them being future humans concerned with how our system of economic exchange and resource usage may be impacting them and their ability to live on the same planet, and what they may be willing to do to certain segments of the population to free up space, so to speak.
Assuming
in their time frame, you mean?
Well, this. Let me ask you. That kind of relates to my next question, so maybe you can help answer both at the same time. Which is, when, you know, for instance, at the school in South Africa, the kids were told, because two things: one, the kids were told technology is bad, basically, like stay away from technology; it's not doing, you know, protect the planet. They seem more interested in the planet than the people on it,
for sure. Yeah,
and they suggest that technology is not doing us a whole lot of favors.
Which I just like to point out is kind of an oxymoron, since they arrived in technology.
Yeah, well, someone should point that out to them.
Oh, they're hypocrites.
Yeah, they're hypocrites.
They're definitely human. They're definitely
at least
human.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If anything indicates they're us, it's definitely that.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, don't fuck it up, because we just fucked it up. It's like, okay, thanks.
Right.
Don't do what I did. So I guess that just relates to, are they in your theory, or in this idea, is there a future that can change? I mean, there's one thing where there's the kind of benign anthropological, let me look at this creature, study this creature, examine our past. That's interesting. I'd want to do that if I was a future time traveler. I'd want to look at the ancient past. And then there's our future could change by the result of us interacting with the behavior of the past, and that suggests a non-fixed future. I guess it's a paradox. Maybe I'm missing,
I discussed that. You guys should have switched books, probably, because I discussed that exact same thing.
Well, that's why you're here. You can explain all the stuff we didn't read.
Exactly. Yeah. Cut to the chase. In chapter 13, with regard to the nukes question. But I know you guys divided and conquered the first two books. I would recommend you both read the third, because the entire book is about exactly this question.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. It, from start to finish. It's a story, you know, a nuanced time travel, highly satirical. People have told me it's very funny too. But it's about this issue of them either needing some sort of cataclysm or trying to avoid it. And that's been this narrative for a couple of years. Cole Hart's talked about this, Frank Milburn. I've discussed it a number of times as well. A lot of that seemingly coming from the intelligence community. but the question of, can they change it? No, they can't change anything. However, they have a much greater awareness of situations than we do. And I can't help but wonder, and this is what I talk about in the extratempestrial model with regard to the nukes question, is when they shut down these missiles here in Montana, at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, were they doing that because they saw something we didn't? Was there going to be an accidental launch, or were they just testing to see if they could, in case they had to? Now, it doesn't necessarily mean they're coming back to change anything, where we all nuke ourselves and they come back to stop it from happening. That's technically not possible. But if they see the writing on the wall, and many could argue each passing day, the writing is just being thrown like shit across the wall, things would be more apparent to them than us, because they see further down the road than we do. So I think it's more of an intervention, because, as I said in my Phoenix talk, we're a bunch of drunk monkeys juggling chainsaws, and we probably look so primitive to them in so many ways, but we also have thermonuclear weapons. And like you said, it's always about take care of the earth, take care of the earth. It's not about stopping Hitler or the genocide in Darfur. You know, it's about take care of this planet. Y'all just do whatever you want. Kill off as many as you want to, because that actually helps us. If you think about it in the context of them being stakeholders in the sanctity of this planet, the fewer of us there are, then the better the planet is for them. And a buddy of mine once told me, when my first book came out, he said, I read this since I was a kid. I had this fear of an alien attack. Like, these extraterrestrials will come here, they'll blow us all up or enslave us or something. After reading your book, I realized, well, if they're us, why would they do that? Why would they hurt us? You know? But I also have to consider, with that in mind, Tom, if the planet is paramount, do we matter? Clearly, some of us survive, or they wouldn't be here if they are time travelers, if they are future humans. But do we all matter? Do we all need to survive? That's what keeps me up at night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was also wondering, and I could be, I just might not understand the paradoxes, and that's very possible. But is there anything to the idea if that the now, despite all the self-help literature, some of which I'm very much a fan of, but this idea of the present as just the only thing versus the present being something that's actually not really identifiable at all, and it is all sort of block time, everything kind of coexisting, that right. some cataclysm that would take place now, how do I put this, would impact a future at the same time, but not in a sense of, I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, like that we could impact the future through an event that happens now, but not in a linear sense. Like if the future coexists with our present and coexists with our past, could an event fuck up the future even if it wasn't consecutive? Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And you know, that's hard. And it's mind-bending for me too. Because as much as all of these events exist, you know, there isn't presentism. That idea has kind of been out the window since we were all doing bong hits in the 70s with the postmodern movement. But we know that all of these moments are real, past, present, and future. The future can affect the past. That in itself is something is hard for us to understand, because we're taught from kindergarten, line these pictures up. You know, Debbie rakes the leaves and then Jimmy jumps in them. Which one came first? Like, my kids had to do this all the time, and I was scrambling around like, don't believe this.
Don't listen to this. It's propaganda.
Yeah, it's propaganda.
Bullshit.
That's what I should have told him. So yeah, it's hard to conceptualize that, because we do live in a physical reality where we perceive linear time. So yes, I can't explain how that would work, but so Igor Novikov, one of my favorite quotes of his is that the past, present, and the future in the presence of a time machine are all one. They're indistinguishable from each other. So with that in mind, yes, it's absolutely possible.
And that's also Einstein's view.
Yeah. That's the block universe. With the ability to travel through time, though, you're not changing things, but you're creating things too. So it's hard for us with our stupid little linear minds from kindergarten to really understand what that means. And I still struggle with that as well.
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to remember, what was the term? I mean, Stephen Hawking, a chronological something.
Protection conjecture.
Yeah. What do you think of that? It seems like something that Stephen Hawking just made up because he wanted it to be there.
Kind of like
the universal constant.
Yeah. I've got great respect for the man. He overcame so much with his amyotrophic lateral sclerosis and just everything at it.
He's pretty smart. Yeah.
Well, he had that going for him. Yeah. I think we can all agree that. And by all accounts, he was a fascinating, hilarious guy. I saw an interview with him and John Oliver, and he was just cracking jokes left and right. I was like, this dude is funny, you know, like I wouldn't necessarily expect that. But so, yeah, I think you're right, though. And he was clearly anti-time travel. He did that stupid experiment where he sent out invitations for time travelers to come. Nobody showed up. So clearly time travel is not real. There's a lot of logical paradoxes in that. He had, toward the end of his life, he had this PBS documentary about time travel, and the whole thing was essentially propaganda about why backward time travel could never be real. And he was almost like the Neil deGrasse Tyson of UFOs, but with time travel, you know?
Yeah.
Just and shitting Spence all over
fighting words.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'll throw down with the dude.
Oh, no, I can't. I used to be used
maybe
to love
not
Neil
like
deGrasse
in a
Tyson.
Boxing match or something. Like, I'm a decent fighter, but he's probably got a few inches on me.
He has become the most irritating science spokesman on the planet.
Wow. It's so ridiculous. Yeah. Like, just, dude, you can't keep doubling down forever, you know? Yeah.
And
like,
as a comedian,
some point, you got to eat your hat.
And as a comedian, he's got to get better at telling jokes if he's going to keep doing it. That's the problem.
Yeah, you got to have some way to, I don't know. I've gone off on too many tangents about him in the past. I'm trying to rein it in. It's a trigger point.
But essentially, I guess there's two roadblocks that have been put up by people who want to, there's the mainstream physics has put up the argument that, you know, they can't be extraterrestrial because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, and it would just take too long to get here. And that argument, and then you had the argument against time travel, which is the notion that it is somehow fundamentally within physics impossible. We can travel. We know we can travel forward in time. We know we can accelerate. We know we can slow time. Mm-hmm. Through, but the argument that you can't, that argument that you cannot possibly travel backward through time, is there, I'm guess, is there any, is there experimental, data that supports time travel now that you say, or even that, that information can travel backward in time? Cause I thought, I mean, I knew about the quantum eraser.
I'm living proof that information can travel back in time.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Is there something other than the experiences of people which...
Well, here's the thing, is it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because any experiment we do in this physical universe is based on our understanding of space and time as we understand it. Mm-hmm. Here's the rub. We don't understand it. Ask any cosmologist, ask any physicist, they'll tell you that time, definitely, and space, most likely, even Sean Carroll says this, is an emergent phenomenon. It emerges from something else that is fundamental. And until we know what's fundamental that space and time emerge from, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. We can't know. Any experiment's going to be nonsense because we're not getting at the root of what is actually the thing that is causing the things that we perceive. So it's not like, it's not some kind of cop-out. It's just, it's like saying, well, I see ants on the ground, so that must be the smallest animal because we can't see farther past that. We can't see what is at the root, the cells that build it, the atoms, the quarks. And we can study these things, but we don't know what time is. Clearly, at least I would argue, our descendants do. They figured it out. They've probably melded quantum mechanics and general relativity. They probably have this grand unified theory in their they're doing it. At this point, we can't. And I was very cautious in my first book to acknowledge that. I'm like, this is where I am in my primitive little monkey brain, trying to understand a technology that exists thousands of years ahead of us.
Well, I guess that's kind of what
the best we can do.
That's what I was getting at, that I think the one indication that that you're talking to someone who is going to be proven wrong is if they start talking about what is possible and what is impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you follow the work of Jeffrey Kripal at all, who is the one that organized that opening the archives of the impossible with Willy Strieber, Jacques Vallée, Diana Pasolka, all of these, you know, really incredible people now, like Edwin May, who ran the Stargate project with all of those remote viewers for the CIA. He this is his thing. This is his baby. Is the impossible, you know? What is impossible if we don't understand the universe? How can we say anything's impossible? You can say ghosts are impossible. You can say faster than light travel is impossible. But the way we understand it, sure. Backward time travel, impossible. Leaving your body and experiencing all things at all times. So yeah, we got to stop using that word because we just don't have a good enough understanding of reality.
Yeah.
The one question I would have about... how we start to get there. The two thoughts I'm holding in my head, which is my head can only hold two thoughts at one time. So the two thoughts.
Well, there's only two sides of the brain.
So well, yeah. It's, yeah. And Mike, I might be an extreme example of that, but is the idea of like, I'm very, you're very persuasive about, you know, the ETs and it makes a lot of sense to me, like that there might not be as much life or as much, in the near neighborhood that we're living in as a planet. And I also feel that at the same time, the universe is teeming with life.
Yeah,
and not just teeming with life, but it seems like teeming with life that is in kind of proximity to us. You mentioned DMT earlier. I'm new to all this kind of stuff, but and I won't be partaking because I'm just, you know, too much of a scaredy cat and neurotic, but I will read about it and have read a great deal about it. And we've talked with folks about it here. And I do find it fascinating that this does seem to be this very unique molecule that is allowing people to interact with entities that, I mean, as someone who did plenty of hallucinogens in his day and, you know, lots of, you know, this and that, you know, that's pretty new. And I know it's not new from a, you know, we know there's cultures and indigenous cultures have been using, you know, ayahuasca, is that the right way to say it?
Ayahuasca.
And I know this is a derivative of that, but
and this, peyote is...
this feels like, and I haven't done peyote, but this, but the DMT phenomenon and it's seemingly that it's ongoing, that you can visit where you were, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And the fact that there
people
are so
have
many
girlfriends and boyfriends in this DMT space.
I haven't gotten quite to that, but I do know that it's becoming, me, the idea of a chemical gateway is persuasive. And do you think it accommodates the time traveler idea?
Well, what's even crazier about DMT is it's naturally occurring in the brain, in the pineal gland of the brain. And it's thought, based on Rick Straussman's book, The Spirit Molecule.
Yeah, which is amazing. Yeah, which is amazing.
It's a great book. Fantastic book. Yeah. Yes. As you know, then, it sort of welcomes you into that realm. It's what
the near-death experience molecule, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you can synthesize that and obviously take it in various mental states. And yeah, like I said, people go to the same space and have girlfriends and boyfriends, or they'll interact with these same DMT entities. And a lot of them report very similar things to UFO encounters, very humanoid beings or high levels of consciousness or purely energetic beings that can communicate in these same ways. So, and that in itself, you know, even outside of whether or not we fully understand the laws of physics or the emergent properties of space and time, that challenges our notions of reality on such a high level. I mean, and even at lower levels of that, you're right, psilocybin, LSD, ayahuasca, peyote, 2CB, mescaline, all of these drugs give you a sense of this universe that exists all around us that I'm going to go out on a limb and say is probably closer to the real reality than this castrated, circumscribed physical reality actually is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great way to, that's a really interesting way to put it too. Cause I mean, speaking to, you know, my own LSD experiences, it was, even though I wasn't like a big explorer, it was more like this is a touch overwhelming, but it was overwhelming because there was this sense of so much not accessed or so much there that is just slightly beyond, in that experience, my own like ability to get there or my ability to see it. And it was more just that overwhelm, which of course at the time you're just like, it's just a powerful drug and it just, you know, whatever it's doing. And yet it feels like this, the evolutions, the evolution of our,
then
of
you
our
say,
chemistry.
But was that actually more real? You know, everybody should ask themselves that on a trip.
That launch point. Go ahead, Dave.
It reminds me like a lot of the things that Donald Hoffman talks about.
Yeah, absolutely.
His
a great resource.
Yeah, his argument that, you know, that evolution by necessity selected for us to not be able to perceive reality. That, you know, as we said before, you know, because all you really need to do is find a mate and avoid getting eaten.
And he goes even deeper, like the way we perceive colors and tastes and sounds and everything. It's just such a small microcosm of what is likely a much, much more complex reality. Yeah.
And then ironically, he refuses to do DMT.
Oh, really?
No, I actually saw an interview with someone who was, what was he on? Was that Into the Impossible podcast?
We all don't want to subject ourselves to this, Dave.
I'll do it. You're in LA. I think there's somewhere around LA you can do it. I'd like to do it legally, course. I may allegedly, for legal purposes, have done everything except that.
Yeah.
DMT. I'd like to try it. I've tried it twice, but my, as I said, the antidepressants I was on, I think, were blocking it.
yeah.
Because I'm the only person I know of who's done like four or five hits of DMT and
felt nothing.
And was still just sitting there going, oh, my throat feels like shit. But, yeah, but
they are they're walking around with one hitters of DMT here in sunny LA. It's the new cigarette.
I don't want that. I want the full experience. I want shamans. I want
I want to see sage.
Me too.
I definitely would like to go someplace beautiful and try ayahuasca.
Well, let's all do it. Let's go to an ayahuasca retreat.
Go down to Costa Rica. And...
I'll be your guide, guys. I'll be your guide, and I will, or at least I'll watch out for make sure you don't, hurt yourselves. Cause I will just keep reading the books on
that
front.
There are some dangerous animals down there.
Yeah. But, and especially in that Montana, you got bears. Yeah. I don't know what you got, but moose.
Yeah.
Costa Rica, you get all those beautiful sloths.
That's true.
Well, I read this.
In a DMT or ayahuasca trip, that might be the most dangerous animal ever. Cause it's moving all slow. You're tripping biscuits there and this thing's coming down at you.
I don't know.
Trying to give you a hug and you're just shitting your pants.
To me, after reading the spirit molecule and some of the reports back from the front, I was like, I'm out. Cause I know I'm going to be the 30% that gets, raped by the lizard people. I don't need that in my life. I got enough stuff to worry about.
We all draw the line somewhere.
I think that's a fair line. I'm not going to, I don't think that I'm going out on a limb.
I'm willing to do it too. I'll take one for the team.
All right.
Yeah.
I heard they're not very well endowed. So
Jesus, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
I think it's, look, this is all super cool. This is, we are really grateful for your time. I love this talk. We would love to have you back. As Dave and I
finish,
process information,
we'll swap books and we'll both read the third book.
Read the third, and then we'll do ayahuasca and we'll come back and, talk
or
again.
Do ayahuasca and well on a podcast. We'll do.
That's
Has
it.
I will. Done that?
I will narrate.
You would think if Rogan hasn't done it, then no one's done it.
I'll check his tapes and I'll circle back.
So let me just remind everyone, Dr. Michael Masters, the books that are all excellent, and we're looking forward to his most recent, which is Revelation, The Future Human Past. But there's also The Extratempestrial Model and Identified Flying Objects, A Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon. Super cool stuff and a real pleasure to have you, sir.
It's been an absolute blast for me. Thank you both.
Awesome. All right. We'll talk again soon.
Appreciate it so much.
Thanks, Dr. Masters.
Take care.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.